Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
That seems like a simple solution, right? I mean, you have these living rebels who would be doing fine if they were well-armed and well-trained against Gaddafi's
possibly.
Army.
Right. They want to fight. They need weapons.
Right.
We want
simple solution. We want Gaddafi
defeated.
Gone, right?
Exactly.
They are the enemy of our enemy, so give them some weapons so they can fight this battle on their own. It becomes complicated because they already have some weapons, right? They already captured weapons and arms from Gaddafi's army and reportedly don't know entirely how to use them.
And
so,
indeed, the U.S. policy isn't completely clear. We do know that the president, according to reports, has signed a finding authorizing the use of weapons transfers to the opposition in Libya.
Right.
But there's still a debate in the administration over how this is going to play out.
Exactly. And we're joined now by Jason Burke, who's South Asia correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, author of Al-Qaeda, The True Story of Radical Islam. And the reason that we're talking to you today, Jason, is because we've been hearing about these flickers of Al-Qaeda and flickers of extremism somewhere among the rebel opposition in Libya. And that makes little people a little bit nervous about giving them weapons. How credible are these reports that Al-Qaeda is beginning to play a role in Libya?
I think we have to be very careful going from flickers of radical Islam to Al-Qaeda playing a role. And they're very different things. One thing you have to say straight off is that the area we're talking about, Benghazi and particularly a town called Darna, which is further out towards the Egyptian border, have long had some kind of Islamic militant activity. That was largely obviously in opposition to Gaddafi's regime for several decades. Gaddafi acted very strongly against that. There were a series of crackdowns, brutal crackdowns, that effectively eradicated most of those networks. We saw a significant number, several hundred young men from those towns, Darna particularly, going to Iraq in the sort of 2004, 2005, 2006 period. That then later stopped. I was told by a former Libyan militant who knows the situation there very well, there is a residual level among particularly young teenagers of attraction for Salafi Islam, as there is pretty much anywhere in the Middle East, but it really is very, very minor. Now, in terms of Al-Qaeda itself, almost nothing, as far as we know. There have been a few probes, if you like, by Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. That's the Al-Qaeda hardcore's affiliate in the region, into the south of Libya. But in terms of genuine presence of anyone connected to the group we know as Al-Qaeda in and around the area held by the rebels, no serious evidence of that for the moment.
All right. We're also joined by Dean Baker, who's assistant professor of philosophy at the United States Naval Academy. So, Dean Baker, I guess that must be reassuring that we haven't seen any real presence of Al-Qaeda among the Libyan rebels. But is that going to make us feel a little bit more comfortable arming them, or should we still be worried about the example that we have from Afghanistan?
Well, I think, we have a kind of a responsibility. We've got involved in this, and at some point we're going to have to just make a call. These things are always uncertain to some degree, but I think the evidence does look fairly good at the moment that we wouldn't be pouring weapons into the hands of the wrong people. So I'm pretty comfortable with that, at least from what I know. And I think really the issue with Afghanistan was less about the weapons that we put in there, and more about the fact that we kind of let things go as soon as the Soviets pulled out, and we didn't keep a finger on things. I think that was the real problem rather than the weapons. My own view is I think that, and I should say this is my own view, it doesn't represent the Naval Academy or anybody else, but I think that supplying weapons is less of a deal in Libya. There are plenty of weapons there. What's needed more is some sort of degree of training and organization, and I think that's where the real question mark comes in. Are we going to be able to put people in who are going to help shape this rebel of rebels, if you like, into a real fighting force?
Well, what is the is there a legal distinction, I guess, between just giving arms to an opposition force and actually training them? I mean, during Afghanistan, they shipped them out. They brought them to training camps in other countries. They completely trained them in Western-style warfare. Is that different than just handing them weapons?
Well, in effect, it's different. I don't claim to be a lawyer, so I'm not going to try and answer the legal question. I mean, you can simply ship weapons out, right? But if you want, if the point of shipping weapons is for them to be effective, and ultimately, if you don't enable them to use them effectively, it's pretty much a waste of money. It's pointless. So I think we should see those two things as going hand in hand.
So, Jason Burke, you know, how does this happen in practice? If we are going to embark on an elaborate training program, and again, that hasn't been decided in Libya, does it mean putting Libyan opposition folks on the payroll of the U.S. government? What's the precedent for actually creating an organizational hierarchy that would organize and control this opposition to some extent?
I just wanted to go back. It's a very interesting question, but what I wanted to go back for a moment to the whole point of Afghanistan, which I think people keep coming back to, and the training of the Mujahideen, which is obviously the big example of the sort of fearful example, if you like, which everyone's coming to, saying we trained Bin Laden and Al Qaeda, and now they've come back to haunt us in the sort of terrible Frankenstein monster sort of way. It actually didn't quite happen like that. The CIA. And others funneled all their aid through the Pakistanis. The Pakistanis actually did not train Al-Qaeda as such. They did not train the Arabs, who were largely Arabs, the internationals who were in or trying to fight in Afghanistan, who were in Pakistan at the time. They trained the Afghans. None of the Afghans have actually come and attacked or become part of Al-Qaeda, if you like. The problem was actually militants who piggybacked that local conflict, the conflict in Afghanistan between the Afghans and the Soviets, international militants who piggybacked that conflict and then went on themselves to get their own training, basically. So the situation is somewhat different now than it was back then. If we're looking at that example, the obvious way to go would be down finding a substitute for the Pakistani role back then, which it would, the obvious candidates would be Egypt, and have the Egyptians run the distribution, bringing people out of Libya, eastern Libya, into Egypt, training them there, sending them back over with arms. That obviously depends on a stable, favorable, moderate, if you like, Egyptian government.
Yeah.
And as we know, everything's to play for there at the moment.
So, okay, Jason, so we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That's Jason Burke, South Asia correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, author of Al-Qaeda, The True Story of Radical Islam. We also spoke to Dean Baker, assistant professor of philosophy at the United States Naval Academy.